and I'm all of this, it is healthy.
No.
It's healthy, I can't move my arms. I requested medical for a long time, didn't know anything about it.
No, I mean, it looks like you're healing well to me. You know, I'm not a doctor, but I think you're getting good medical care.
No, I'm not. You're not here.
The president rushed through the Military Commissions Act, establishing military tribunals for accused terrorist detainees.
The Supreme Court ruled that the military commissions needed to be explicitly authorized by the United States Congress. And so I asked Congress for that authority, and they have provided it. These military commissions will provide a fair trial.
As president, I will close Guantanamo, reject the Military Commissions Act, and adhere to the Geneva Conventions. Our Constitution and our Uniform Code of Military Justice provide a framework for dealing with the terrorists. We will close the Guantanamo Bay detention camp and determine how to deal with those who have been held there. In dealing with the situation, we don't have the luxury of starting from scratch. We're cleaning up something that is quite simply a mess. A misguided experiment that has left in its wake a flood of legal challenges that my administration is forced to deal with on a constant, almost daily basis.
When President George W. Bush declared war on Afghanistan in 2001, his military order stipulated that any former, present, or future members of Al-Qaeda and any individual who could in any way be thought to have engaged in terrorism, directly or indirectly, should be detained and, when tried, to be tried for violations of the laws of war and other applicable laws by military tribunals. These tribunals would later come to be known as military commissions. Thus began the saga of Omar Khadr's detention. Khadr, a Canadian citizen, was severely wounded in a firefight in Afghanistan on the 27th of July, 2002. As the only survivor of the raid, Khadr was captured and transferred to the U.S. Air Base in Bagram, Afghanistan, where he was held for 3 months. In October 2002, he was transferred to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where his trial by military commission is now about to begin, after nearly 8 years of indefinite detention. Khadr was held incommunicado at Guantanamo Bay for 2 years. In 2004, he was defined as an enemy combatant by the Combatant Status Review Tribunal. He was first charged in 2005, 3 years after his detention, in accordance with President Bush's military order establishing military commissions. Khadr was accused of murdering Sergeant Christopher Speer and charged with attempted murder, both in violation of the law of war. He was also charged with conspiracy, providing material support for terrorism, and spying. President Bush's military order said that it was not practicable to apply the same principles of law and the rules of evidence that is customary in the trial of criminal cases under regular domestic law. The military commissions extended fewer procedural protections than a traditional courts-martial, the system ordinarily used for trying war crimes under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. For instance, the military commissions reserved the right to limit the defense's access to evidence, to use statements obtained through cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment or punishment, and statements from undisclosed or absent sources. The initial charges against Khadr never reached trial. In 2006, 1 year after the charges were laid, the U.S. Supreme Court reviewed a habeas corpus challenge by Salim Hamdan, Osama bin Laden's personal driver and bodyguard, and one of Khadr's fellow detainees at Guantanamo. The court declared the military commissions unlawful according to the standards set forth by the Uniform Code of Military Justice and Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions. The Military Commissions Act, passed in October of 2006, further denied detainees their legal rights. The act allowed trials to continue in the absence of the defendant, and allowed the Secretary of Defense to appoint military judges. It also approved the introduction of coerced evidence and evidence obtained without a warrant, and denied defendants the right to a speedy trial. The first conviction by the military commissions at Guantanamo was handed down in 2007. David Hicks, an Australian national charged with attempted murder and providing material support to terrorism, reached a plea bargain with the United States government and was convicted 5 years after his initial detention. Hicks was sentenced to 7 years imprisonment, but served only 9 months in Australia as a result of the plea bargain. Andrea Prasau, senior counsel in Human Rights Watch's Terrorism and Counterterrorism Program and former defense counsel at the Office of Military Commissions, expands on the consequences of the procedural delays at Guantanamo.
The length of time it takes to bring a prosecution in Guantanamo itself causes a harm to the detainees. There are delays for two reasons. One is a very good reason. People have challenged the system, and even though the system has been modified, it continues to have some very serious problems procedurally and conceptually. But the second reason is that prosecuting detainees happens when the government feels like doing it. The requirement in the U.S. Constitution that a defendant have the right to a speedy trial has been carved out of the military commission process. So the U.S. government asserts the right to hold people for, say, 40 years and then decide to prosecute them at some point in the future. I think that's tremendously harmful to the defendants, and I think that what it does most significantly is it damages their ability to work with their lawyers. I think it really damages their ability to trust lawyers, and I think we've seen that with Omar Khadr's case.
Further delays to the trial process occurred after the implementation of the Military Commissions Act of 2006. In April 2007, Omar Khadr was charged under the newly established act, but the military judge for his case dismissed the charges because he had only been classified as an enemy combatant, not as an unlawful enemy combatant, a new category that had been established by the congressionally approved Military Commissions Act. The judge claimed he lacked the authority to determine Khadr's status. The Court of Military Commissions then overturned the judge's decision, saying that the commissions did, in fact, have the jurisdiction to categorize detainees. Such procedural delays have plagued all of the cases at Guantanamo. In U.S. domestic courts, on the other hand, convictions relating to terrorism have been handed down much more quickly.
Since September 11th, in U.S. federal court, there have been approximately 500 prosecutions of terrorism-related offenses, 500 convictions of terrorism-related offenses.
Andrea Prasau says that the small number of convictions reached in Guantanamo's military commissions highlights how ineffective the proceedings have turned out to be.
In that same time period, there have been three different iterations of the military commission system, and there have been four convictions. Two of them were guilty pleas. Two of the people who were convicted are free in their home countries right now. So I think when you compare those numbers, the most noticeable factor is that the military commission process is extremely slow.
One of the major criticisms leveled against the military commissions and at the United States government's detention policies in the current conflict has been the admission of evidence obtained by torture. The Bush administration admitted to using what it called enhanced interrogation techniques, but stopped short of defining these techniques as torture. According to Dr. Stephen Reisner, adjunct professor in the program in clinical psychology at Columbia University, the techniques employed by the administration amount to torture as it has been defined by international law.
The term is a euphemism for techniques that would have been prohibited under international law. There are a list of techniques that the Office of Legal Counsel of the Justice Department created, mostly based on what were considered SEER techniques. The SEER program was this program that used techniques such as isolation, humiliation, and waterboarding. The Office of Legal Counsel legalized about 15 or so of these techniques and decided, based on extensive research, that they weren't torture because the definition of torture was recast as techniques that would cause permanent and lasting physical or mental harm. So if you had a physician at the ready or a psychologist at the ready certifying that these techniques would not cause such harm in these cases, the techniques were not considered torture by the American government.
Omar Khadr's harsh treatment at the hands of his captors allegedly began at the U.S. air base in Bagram. It has been alleged that Khadr was singled out for verbal and physical abuse because he was believed to have killed a U.S. soldier. In his affidavit, Khadr said that he was subject to burdensome labor while still injured from being shot at the firefight, and that he was verbally and physically abused during interrogations. One of Khadr's interrogators was subsequently convicted in courts-martial for abusing unidentified detainees. Khadr has claimed that he was interrogated 42 times in 90 days before he was transferred to Guantanamo Bay. Andrea Presau, who has visited Guantanamo both as a defense attorney and a human rights observer, describes the impressions of the detention facility there.
I find Guantanamo to be a very depressing place. No matter how much time I spend there, I always have trouble sleeping. The military commissions take place in what looks like a sort of normal legal-type complex, and it's easy to forget when you're there observing them that just down the road there are the detention camps and that over time hundreds of detainees have spent years being held there indefinitely. And I think that the sense that something is slightly off permeates the experience of being in Guantanamo.
Khadr's abuse is alleged to have continued at Guantanamo. His affidavit claims that he was kept in isolation in a punitively cold cell for 30 days and that he was threatened with acts of sexual violence during his interrogations. David Glazier, a law professor at Loyola University who specializes in international law and is a former commander of the U.S. Navy, argues that the United States' employment of torture not only breaches international law, but also undermines the government's ultimate ends in combating terrorism.
Even treating someone as a prisoner of war under the Geneva Conventions, there are no limits as far as what you can ask in terms of subject matter. There are no limits in terms of how long you can ask questions. And certainly all of the experts on interrogation, both military and civilian, you're unanimous in their agreement that rapport-building techniques are really the key to getting reliable information from someone. And I think it would have worked practically as well. What people seem to forget is that these rules weren't just drafted by idealistic humanitarians. Military people participated over the last two centuries in development of rules contained in the law of war, international humanitarian law, and they're effective. They let you do what you need to do militarily and prevail.
The government is now in the terrible situation of having people that they've tortured, people that they've made very serious claims against, and they haven't figured out a way to bring these cases to trial. So I think there are many problems, not just the fact that they use the torture, interfering with justice being served in these cases.
Closure of Gitmo. Gitmo has caused us problems. There's no question about it. I oversee a region in which the existence of Gitmo has indeed been used by the enemy against us. We have not been without missteps or mistakes.
In addition to inhibiting the government's own ambitions, the use of torture and the lack of due process in the military commissions has repeatedly been said to be counterproductive, as it weakens U.S. credibility in the world. Negative perceptions of the United States have been cited as a source of recruitment for those groups hostile to the conduct of its foreign policy.
I think the recruitment tool is the most significant factor, and that's something I've said. It's also something that Colin Powell has said, that General Petraeus has said, that when fighting in Iraq, the foreign fighters, non-Iraqis who were there, would say, "We're here because of Guantanamo. That's why we're fighting Americans." And I think that's incredibly dangerous to U.S. national security. And as long as Guantanamo remains open and people are prosecuted in a substandard form of justice, that rallying cry for al-Qaeda remains available. So I think that's quite damaging. And then in terms of foreign relations that the U.S. has with other nations, there have been reports that some countries won't provide evidence to be used in a military commission, but they would provide evidence for a federal court prosecution. I think that sort of statement is a real blow to the U.S.'s attempt to portray the military commissions as a valid system.
Carter's case was supposed to go to trial under the Military Commissions Act of 2006, but after President Obama took office, his predicament seemed to be changing.
We will immediately undertake a comprehensive review to determine how to hold and try terrorism suspects to best protect our nation and the rule of law.
Despite his campaign promises to close Guantanamo and abolish the military commissions, the system was reinstated in the Military Commissions Act of 2009.
I think the Obama administration feels stuck. It inherited a very messy situation in Guantanamo. And politically, I don't really understand why they chose to move forward with the military commissions. We had certainly hoped that President Obama would scrap them entirely and simply prosecute detainees in federal court or release the ones for whom there is not sufficient evidence.
The latest Military Commissions Act addressed some of the deficiencies present in the Act of 2006. It prohibited the admission of evidence obtained through torture and sought to restrict the admissibility of hearsay evidence. But it has been questioned whether or not these changes will have a substantive impact on the proceedings at the military commissions.
There are sort of two problems. One is that the American legal system, including the military commissions, is based on an adversarial system. And so if the prosecutors are willing to go ahead and try to admit evidence and claim that it meets the standards for admissibility, it really then shifts the burden to the defense to sort of make an argument to the judge as to why that evidence should not be allowed in. And the government is classified everything to do with the detainee treatment and has made it all but impossible for the defense to get accurate information about how the information was obtained. So that burden, that practical burden shifting, essentially it seems in practice to be sort of opening the door for, you know, a judge to say, well, I have to admit this because the defense hasn't been able to show me that this information was obtained through improper means.
It has also been claimed that some of the fundamental flaws of the original Military Commissions Act remain.
The Military Commissions Act of 2009 did make some significant improvements to the military commissions procedures, but it didn't go far enough. First of all, there's a fundamental problem with having an alternative legal system for only certain detainees. There's a constitutional problem because it only applies to non-U.S. citizens. It's a substandard form of justice only for non-Americans, which is highly problematic both from sort of a foreign relations perspective but also under the U.S. Constitution. The military commissions purport to have jurisdiction over conduct that has never before been understood to be a violation of international law, which means those charges should not be brought in a military commission. So there are some fundamental problems, including the admission of hearsay evidence and the possibility of evidence obtained by coercive means, that really just come together to form a flawed legal system, one that I think has not been accepted by any other country, that no other nation believes to be an appropriate forum for prosecuting terrorism suspects.
The president assumed the Geneva Convention did not apply to the war on terror. Humane treatment did. I agreed with that. The Supreme Court says the Geneva Convention applies. So what I would like to do is give our president...
Under my administration, the United States does not torture. We will abide by the Geneva Conventions. We will uphold our highest values and ideals.
So what recourse was available to the United States? What were the alternatives to the controversial application of the law of war that both the Bush and Obama administrations have come to uphold? David Glazer maintains that the United States deviated from their traditional application of the Geneva Conventions, which govern the conduct of warfare, when the military commissions were authorized in 2001. Rather than adhering to the Geneva Conventions, the Bush administration urged the government to proceed with an ad hoc formulation of the laws of war.
I think it's safe to say the United States was totally unprepared. in all of the conflicts that the U.S. has been involved in the past half century, it has employed the full Geneva Convention rules, whether it was legally obligated to or not. And so when the U.S. political leadership decided that it didn't want to apply the convention rules to this conflict, there was just a total void because the military had never thought about how to proceed without applying those rules, and the civilian leadership that was involved in the decision-making process really was wholly ignorant of international law as a whole, and so they had no constructive alternatives in mind, and the country has simply been floundering ever since.
One of the main issues that have dogged the military commissions from their outset has been the issue of jurisdiction. The law of war, which in the United States is to be applied at military commissions and at the courts-martial, only has jurisdiction over participants regarded as privileged combatants.
The law of war is all about giving soldiers the right to engage in combat, and the price that a soldier pays for the right to engage in violence himself is that he is in turn liable to be killed or wounded at essentially any time or place until he actually separates from the military or is placed out of action by being captured or being disabled.
The legal precedent cited by the Bush administration for detaining and prosecuting so-called enemy combatants, unlawful enemy combatants, and alien unprivileged enemy belligerents, as they were dubbed in the 2009 Military Commissions Act, was taken from a trial of German soldiers carried out by military commission during the Second World War. However, Dr. Glaser cites an important distinction between those German soldiers and the detainees at Guantanamo.
These were actually members of the German military who would have been privileged belligerents, but for the fact that when they came ashore on the American beaches, they buried their uniforms and then chose to blend in with the civilian population. And it was that act, the court says, which made it possible for them to be prosecuted by a military tribunal, because they actually were members of the German military who chose not to follow the rules. But that doesn't mean that someone that's part of an organization which as a blanket matter doesn't comport with the law of war is subject to trial under the law of war. That was an important distinction that was pretty much lost on the people making the policy decisions.
Members of resistance movements can be considered privileged belligerents under the Geneva Conventions, thereby falling under the jurisdiction of the laws of war. But in order to qualify, they must form part of a command structure, carry arms openly, carry a fixed distinctive sign recognizable at a distance, and conduct their operations in accordance with the law of war. Even detainees who have fought for Al-Qaeda thus fail to qualify. As David Glaser explains, there are other options for holding these individuals accountable for their actions in accordance with international law.
Virtually all serious law of war scholars are in agreement that if they engage in violence, if they kill or injure someone or they destroy property, then they can be prosecuted under regular national criminal law. So someone, for example, fighting in Afghanistan who injures or kills an American could be prosecuted as a criminal under Afghan law, or potentially could be prosecuted under regular U.S. federal law in a regular federal court, but doesn't actually commit a violation of the law of war.
Cotter's case illustrates the problems of applying the law of war to someone who does not enjoy its protections. Cotter himself was injured and his comrades killed in the firefight, but those responsible for their deaths are immune from prosecution under the law of war because they enjoy privileged combatant status. In effect, Cotter is facing the punishments afforded by the law of war, while the United States Army enjoys its protections. Omar Khadr is now 23 years old. He is the youngest detainee at Guantanamo Bay, where he has spent one-third of his life. Next month, his case will go to trial for the third time at the military commissions. Unlike the majority of the detainees at Guantanamo, Khadr is facing charges other than conspiracy and providing material support to terrorism. The charge of murder and attempted murder in violation of the law of war are unprecedented. Cotter is alleged to have thrown the grenade that killed Sergeant Speer.
I can't find any rule anywhere in any source that I've ever read that makes it a crime to kill a soldier under the law of war. The basic idea that you could charge an individual for throwing a hand grenade and killing a soldier in combat is mind-boggling. There's just no serious law of war scholar I know who believes that the law allows you to do that.
The remaining charges against Cotter are also contentious with respect to their applicability under the law of war. According to David Glazer, the charge of providing material support for terrorism is not recognized by international law.
Providing material support to terrorism is an offense which the United States created by statute relatively late in the 20th century, and initially it actually only applied to Americans. It was essentially an offense for which Americans could be charged, almost sort of a treason-lite kind of thing. Then, for some reason, when we started this military commission process, even though there's absolutely no precedent in any historic military commission or any rule in the law of war, nothing similar has been held to be prosecutable by any of the other international courts or tribunals that prosecute war crimes. It really appears that the U.S. simply borrowed this domestic criminal statute and asserted that we could prosecute people by military commission.
After Congress had the opportunity to redress this issue, the Military Commissions Act of 2009 was passed, despite testimonies that spoke to the illegality of the charge.
Last summer, when Congress was reconsidering the Military Commissions Act, and they're moving from the 2006 version to the 2009 version, an assistant attorney general and the general counsel of the Department of Defense both testified that the administration had at least done enough homework to recognize that providing material support to terrorism did not state a violation of the law of war, and therefore they both recommended that it be taken out of the law. And yet the Senate went ahead and reenacted it, and the House followed suit. It just sort of highlights, I think, the fact that these Military Commissions Acts have been very much political creations, and people are just not focused on getting the law right.
The conspiracy charges against Cotter assume complicity in every offense alleged to have been committed by al-Qaeda since its founding in 1989, at which time Cotter was 2 years old.
The idea of conspiracy, meaning two or more people agree together that they will commit a crime, is something that really comes from the Anglo-American system of justice, and many other countries around the world simply don't accept it as part of their criminal code. And so it doesn't make sense that international law, which has to reflect sort of the combined judgment of all countries, is going to recognize an offense that a substantial percentage of the world's legal systems don't. And the final charge against Cotter that we haven't discussed yet, one that really hasn't gotten much attention, is the spying charge. Now, spying is a really interesting offense because it's been recognized by the law of war for more than two centuries, but it's not a war crime. A war crime is basically a violation of the law of war, and any nation that gets its hands on a war criminal can prosecute. So the law of war doesn't make spying a crime as such, but it allows a nation which is the victim of a spy to punish the spy for its own protection, but only if it catches the individual actually behind its lines, engaged in the offense at the time that they're captured. Now, the U.S. government has submitted a charge sheet on Cotter, which says that he was spying on the U.S. in the month of June 2002, but then says that in July 2002, he spent a month getting advanced training on the use of landmines and improvised explosive devices. So the charge sheet itself proves that he successfully returned to his own side after he's alleged to have engaged in the spying, and so the charge sheet provides a clear legal statement that he cannot be prosecuted for spying because he couldn't have been caught behind the lines if he returned to his own side and got a month of training. So You know, to me, that just shows that the prosecutors are either ignorant of the law of war or they actually are treating it with contempt.
Legalities aside, there are several factual issues that call into question the government's accusations against Khadr, while also highlighting the difficulties confronting the defense with respect to gaining access to pertinent evidence. The case against Khadr was originally premised on the claim that when U.S. forces entered the compound, after having called in significant airstrikes, Khadr was the only remaining survivor, thereby eliminating the possibility of the grenade having been thrown by someone else. However, in February of 2008, Guantanamo authorities inadvertently released a document that had been prepared by the Pentagon's Criminal Investigation Task Force that detailed Khadr's capture. The document included testimony of an unidentified soldier, referred to as OC-1, who was present at the firefight on the day of Khadr's capture and was the sole witness to the close-in portions of the firefight. His testimony contradicted initial claims by the prosecution of Khadr's being the sole survivor in the compound. According to the CITF report, OC-1 saw a man facing him lying on his right side. The man had an AK-47 on the ground beside him, and the man was moving. OC-1 fired one round, striking the man in the head, and the movement ceased. OC-1 then saw a second man sitting up, facing away from him, leaning against brush. This man, later identified as Khadr, was moving. OC-1 fired two rounds, both of which struck Khadr in the back. OC-1 estimated that from the initiation of the approach to the compound to shooting Khadr took no more than 90 seconds, with all of the events inside the compound happening in less than a minute. The commanding officer of U.S. forces on the day of Khadr's capture also provided separate, contradicting claims of the events leading up to Khadr's capture. In his initial account, he stated that one badly wounded enemy was able to throw a grenade, which seriously wounded Chris, before the enemy was killed by another, redacted assaulter. However, without explanation, the second account was altered to state that one badly wounded enemy was able to throw a grenade, which seriously wounded Chris, before the enemy was engaged by another redacted assaulter. Could the first account refer not to Omar Khadr, but rather his comrade who was still alive at the time of Sergeant Spear's death? These are questions his defense counsel would like to see addressed at the trial. Some observers of Khadr's trial maintain that all legal and factual issues involved in his case are secondary and of less consequence than the issue of his having been a 15-year-old at the time of his detainment. International law has moved unequivocally towards affording special protections and standards for the treatment of children who have been recruited and deployed in military conflicts. The United States has itself instituted a legal system specific to the needs of children, with an emphasis on promoting their welfare. However, no protections have been afforded to Omar Khadr in light of his age at the time of his capture in 2002. Dr. Reisner highlights several of the reasons why children should be regarded differently than adults.
Just about all legal systems, minors are considered minors and are looked at and given special consideration because they don't have mature ability to make choices and they are very susceptible to influence. And we don't consider them responsible adults and we don't put them on trial, we don't interrogate them, we don't treat them as we do a willing adult in a situation. And the impact of being treated in this way when you're only 15, when you lack the resources to understand what you're going through, why you're going through it, and you lack the maturity to know your rights, to understand your situation altogether, we can see that this would cause a level of damage to the developing psychology of such a person that, you know, we might think differently if he were an adult.
The military commissions have been implemented to bring individuals to trial who pose a considerable risk to American security. The charge sheets suggest that detainees are intimate participants in the planning and execution of the most egregious attacks carried out against American interests. However, casual acquaintance with the facts paints a different picture. David Glazer comments on the more surreal qualities of the prosecutions taking place at Guantanamo.
The idea of trying to charge these folks as part of this overall high-level conspiracy is sort of mind-boggling. Even if conspiracy stated a violation of the law of war, the idea that Cotter, who is only known to have any affiliation with these folks in June and July of 2002, could fairly be associated as a co-conspirator with events, some of which on the charge sheet, if I remember correctly, are actually events that took place before he was born, and all of them took place before his brief affiliation with the organization. It simply, you know, as a matter of law, defies logic.
Join us next week when we discuss the legal, moral, and psychological implications of Omar Khadr's age, and scrutinize the Canadian government's response to Khadr's predicament.